let's try to talk about food more neutrally. Let's try to avoid any kind of association with food equaling morality.
You've just tuned into Rebel Wellness Podcast, your resource for realigning and revitalizing your health and well-being. I'm your host, Kaylee, also known as Coach Kales. I'm a holistic health educator, certified nutritionist, and fitness professional of nearly a decade. I'm stoked to have you with us. You just joined a community of amazing souls who are ready to break free from the confines of the often outdated and confusing health advice all around us. Living in a world overwhelmed by quick fix diets and unrealistic beauty and body standards, us rebels stand for change. If you're like me, you're exhausted with the confusion and polarization plaguing the social media health scene. My mission is to empower you to step beyond today's diet culture. Adopt a holistic health approach paired with the foundations of science for lasting, well-rounded wellness. Through teaching you how to tune in and embrace your mind, body, and soul, we'll reject one-size-fits-all solutions, realigning you on a better path that honors your unique needs and values. With new episodes weekly, this podcast is your sanctuary for deep wellness exploration, featuring expert advice, real-life stories, and a true commitment to your growth. Your journey to better health and simplicity in life begins now. Let's jump right in. What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to the Rebel Wellness Podcast. We have yet another amazing Rebel interview today. I am very excited about today's topic. But before we get into today's episode, I do want to start with a quick note. So we will be talking about eating disordered and disordered eating in this conversation. So if this topic feels heavy or triggering for you, please take care of yourself. Decide whether or not you want to listen to it or what headspace you need to be in to prepare for it. But that could also mean you just skip it altogether, and that's okay. But I honestly think that there is more gold in this, and I do feel that our triggers are our teachers, and it can be really powerful for us to better understand what our triggers are trying to teach us. You know what I mean? But I do want to start this episode by making sure that there is a little heads up there. And it is also important that everything we discuss in this episode is not medical advice. So make sure that you are working with a professional, whether that is your general practitioner or a specialist in nutrition for disordered eating habits, because I think that is kind of one of the biggest takeaways from today's conversation. So I'll give that one to you right up front. But I am so grateful to bring you this conversation with Mariah Martin. She's a registered dietitian and the founder of Sakara Nutrition, where she helps people build healthy, joyful relationships with food. Mariah's work is rooted in promoting balance over restriction, and she's especially passionate about eating disorder recovery and helping folks find body confidence. She's the kind of practitioner who believes that food should be nourishing and enjoyable. Yes, that does include cinnamon rolls, which I absolutely align with as a certified nutritionist as well. And so this is such an important conversation because, you know, like I said, in my own work, I've seen how common disordered eating truly can be. Honestly, 9 out of 10 women I've worked with have struggled with disordered eating or have had a history of eating disorders as well in their youth. So I think that this discussion is something that a lot of us females can especially resonate with. So I think that, you know, because diet culture has normalized so much of disordered eating patterns, this discussion is extremely important. And that's exactly why I wanted to bring Mariah on, to shed light on this topic with care, nuance, and real tools for healing. So for this episode, you guys can expect to hear about the different types of eating disorders, how they can present, the power of language in preventing or healing disordered eating, the importance of building a supportive care team, which you guys know is so important from my past episodes, and how to protect yourself with your relationship to your body and food in a world of social media nutrition, quote unquote, experts. So as always, if this episode resonates with you, share it with whoever you think it could also be beneficial to, which, of course, you know, give a little bit of context because I know that sometimes these topics are a lot. But also, if you know somebody who is struggling, please reach out to a licensed provider who is trained in eating disorder care. We give a lot of really great resources in the show notes, so make sure you check out the show notes for all of the good stuff that we discuss in today's episode. All right, let's get into it. Here's my conversation with Mariah Martin, dietitian. All right, so welcome, Mariah, to Rebel Wellness.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So we're going to have a really great discussion today, a little bit about, or a lot of it, about eating disorders and how dietitians and, you know, certified nutritionists and other professionals in this space can help you rebuild a better relationship to food and kind of move forward with your life without feeling, you know, hopeless and all that kind of stuff, which I know is really helpful for a lot of us, especially females in this day and age. So Mariah, I would love to hear a little bit more for my listeners to know about your background and how you kind of ended up in this, you know, specialty.
Yeah. So that's a funny story. The short story is I told myself I would never, ever be involved with eating disorders. That was the one thing that I was like, I will be so open-minded to anything in my career. Eating disorders is not it. Like, I'm not going to do that, which I think is hilarious now. But so when I was younger, my dad was a chef, and I felt very strongly connected to just food in general. And then as I got older, I was like, okay, well, how is food affecting my body? You know, you're a teenager slash young adult, you know, kind of figuring out how things work. And so when it came time to pick my kind of path in college, I was like, okay, do I want to be a chef or do I want to learn more about the body? And so I picked more about the body. I didn't want to be stuck in the kitchen all day. So I never looked back. I started off, and as I'm sure you know, when you are in a nutrition program to become a dietitian, you have to do an internship. And that's really, unless you have like a very strong idea of where you want to go, like that's where you get to explore a lot of things. So I explored weight loss, I explored diabetes, corporate nutrition. And then one of my very last rotations was with, technically it was a business rotation, but she ran an eating disorder practice, eating disorder focused practice. And within the first time of meeting her and talking with her, I absolutely fell in love with it, which kind of sounds odd to say because it is a very challenging population. But I just felt so passionately about it, and that has not gone away. So that's my longer version of that story.
No, I love that. That's awesome. And it is kind of funny how that stuff kind of happens where you don't expect to ever work with a certain group. And then you're like, maybe that was just something calling me to being like, you should pay attention to this. You know? Right. Which is great. Okay. So in your, would you call it an internship? It's kind of more of
internship.
Yeah. Okay. What did you start working with first? And then how did you kind of expand?
So with an internship as a dietitian or as a soon to be dietitian, you have to have four different rotations, and this is throwing my mind back. I'm like, am I going to remember these? You have to do food service, you get an elective, which mine was business, and then community and clinical. You have to have a clinical.
Oh yeah.
The big one.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have to have four different rotations. I did my food service and my clinical at the same time. And I hated it. I also at the time was working in food service, running a kitchen, and it is what it is. Some people absolutely love it. It was not my jam. I liked working with clients specifically, like one-on-one. And so that was not, it didn't speak to me. But I was happy that I tried it so that I could move on and say like, okay, I'll never have to do that again. That's fine.
Which I think that that's the best part about the internship. I'm going to have to do that too at the end of my program. And I'm thinking about it and I'm like, I am definitely more of a one-on-one person, especially because, you know, just eating disorders as a specialty is so personal, you know, and a lot of people may not even feel comfortable telling you everything the first time you meet, even if it's, they know why they're there, you know what I mean? You have to build that trust.
Yes.
But so once you graduated from that, how did you kind of continue on?
Get into it. So when I was doing my business rotation, I had previously reached out to a woman who worked in a company who specialized in eating disorders. She hadn't happened to get back to me in time for her to actually be my rotation, but I was like, hey, I don't have a job right now. I'm just kind of volunteering and seeing what feels good. Like, can I still come shadow you? So she had to, you know, get the okay by a bunch of her clients, but I didn't. I showed up probably 3-4 times a week for 5 to 8 hours a day. And I would just listen to her sessions and like sit into sessions. And I don't know if I would say that's a very common experience. I've never heard, I mean, I'm sure maybe people do it all the time, but it was something where I was just like, hey, I'm going to do what I want to do and what works for me. And that was invaluable. Like I literally learned so much. I feel like it really shaped who I am as a counselor even now. And at the end of it, like we would have conversations at the end of the day, I would ask questions, kind of like just get more information. And I would say at the end of maybe doing that for 2 months or so, she started to give me some really good feedback. And she's like, hey, would you maybe consider taking a job here? And I feel like that's a little unusual in this field. Usually you work at a treatment center to get experience, have a bunch of other people in a team around you kind of teaching you things. But I feel like I got a very hands-on experience with her. So I just kind of skipped all that and then went straight to counseling. And that's how I started.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of a more unique experience because definitely I know a lot of people have had to go and search and do their own thing and figure it out. And it's not as easy as you might think, even though there's like a lot of places are constantly hiring dietitians. Like I see it all over in LinkedIn and it's just like, how come you have to keep hiring them?
I know.
But, so as you started to kind of develop with your own business, how did you, do you have a specific specialty that you would say just really aligns?
Meaning like a specific eating disorder?
Yes, sorry. Yes, specific.
No, not at all. I have ones that I love and I have ones that I'm good at but don't necessarily love. So there's lots of different kinds. People don't really know as much about OSFED and ARFID. OSFED just means like, hey, we have some really disordered eating and it's affecting weight and it's a serious condition. Like it's enough to be a diagnosis, but it's kind of all over the map. So it's like other unspecified, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. ARFID is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And so it's kind of basically like picky eaters. So picky eaters that maybe are picky eaters, and I'm saying that in quotes for people who are listening, picky eaters who are picky eaters because maybe they had a traumatic experience with food, they almost choked, or they just had a traumatic experience in general, and now there's a lot of anxiety around eating. It usually doesn't have anything to do with body image, whereas anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, a lot of those are also associated with body image. They don't necessarily have to be, but they usually are. I love working with binge. Yes, my top favorite, again, which sounds very silly to say, but the clients that I feel like I really connect with are the binge eating clients.
Okay. Yeah.
And I say that because typically they are just like at the end of their rope when they come to see me. They feel so discouraged. Like, I've tried everything. I've tried this diet. I've tried that diet. This worked and then it didn't. So they've yo-yoed their whole life. And they just feel absolutely hopeless. And it brings me just like a lot of excitement. Again, just hold on. It brings me a lot of excitement to have them coming to see me because I'm like, no, no, no. Like, I know why this is happening. I can help you with this. And so I get very, very excited to be like, hey, like I can already see based off of your history why this is happening. Like, let me walk you through this. And then we can slowly start making changes to figure it out. And then they get really excited. And so I love working with that population, I think, the most, but I definitely see a handful of the others as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I actually will circle back to the binge eating because I think that'll be a really great topic to talk about because I do know a lot of people do struggle with it and they don't know, they may not have a name for it or they may not think it's quite as bad or, you know, and I have an interesting kind of short story about that type of, because I hadn't known that that was as serious of a common, you know, eating disorder as it really is. But with the other two that were the others, the several others that you were just discussing, I actually have not heard that terminology before. So do the first two that you were talking about, are they more of categories for like umbrellas for specific eating disorders then?
Are you talking about OSFED and ARFID?
Yes.
No, they are a diagnosis in and of themselves. It really kind of needed some, I couldn't tell you when it changed, but like in the DSM-5, I couldn't tell you when the terminology changed, but there needed to be another diagnosis that was more specific to like, hey, it doesn't meet this criteria, but there's still some major disordered eating going on. Like, here, let's give it this diagnosis. And then there's sometimes, like you were talking about earlier, there's sometimes where there's just disordered eating kind of peeking through versus an actual diagnosable eating disorder.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So to kind of clarify for listeners, that's kind of like there's scenarios where, you know, some people, for example, might be alcoholics, or there's alcoholism, which like there's a difference between like you have alcoholic tendencies at different chapters in life or something like that. And then otherwise, some people carry alcoholism, which is like a lifetime disorder with alcohol, correct? Right. And so similar for eating disorder, sometimes you can go in and out of eating disorder, disordered eating, but you don't have a chronic lifetime disorder, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so when you kind of discussed a little bit about starting your own business, did you go into it full blown on your own, or how did that come to be?
No, it's so funny because it was something that kind of just happened. I was working through another private practice that actually focused on therapists who worked with people with eating disorders or disordered eating. And so she decided to take me on as the dietitian in the practice so that when, and this is an important topic too, when clients were seeing therapists who specialize in eating disorders, because I think that is incredibly important to know, they also had a dietitian who specialized in eating disorders. That's a whole little sidebar that we can talk about in a second, but to finish this question, I was working with her and then she decided to kind of move her career in a different path. And so she's like, hey, feel free to take these clients and, you know, and like, do you want to do your own thing? And I was like, yep, apparently it's time. So yeah. It just kind of worked out nicely where I was able to say like, okay, I'm kind of just going to do my own thing. I still refer to those therapists and have great connections with them, but organically happened.
No, that's great. And that's really cool that they, you know, took that initiative to incorporate a dietitian alongside their practices. I have observed quite a few professionals will kind of try to just take on those specialties into their own thing. And it's not part of their background.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's really important too, that I think a lot of listeners, if you do work with or are considering working with a disordered eating specialist in therapy, I would also look into a specialist dietitian or certified nutritionist or specialist. It's so hard because some of the jargon nowadays, it's all muddied water because it's not regulated super well.
Yeah.
But kind of to the point, therapists sometimes will learn some stuff from certifications or whatnot, but not understand the depth of nutrition.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's a little tricky. So definitely look for a care team. I talk about that a lot on my podcast. So having multiple specialists is really helpful. It is really funny when, you know, you start your own practice, you do tend to just fall into place, or enough people are like, can you do this thing on your own? And you're like, I'll figure it out.
Yep. You know? One of those things where you have to just be open to how life is going to bring it to you, and it usually happens and it's perfect timing.
So let's dive into now a little bit more deep discussion. Let's continue a little bit about, you know, you've discussed a little bit of the most common eating disorders, but I know there may be some that were left out of that. I'd love for you to kind of give our listeners a little background on some of the most common eating disorders that we do see, how they're defined, and some of the root causes would be awesome.
Sure. So the root causes question I love because that's such a tricky answer. So I'm excited to answer that one. So we talked about binge eating disorder in the sense that that's the one that I like to work with, but that usually means that there's some type of overeating, like unintentional eating, mindless eating, where you're kind of checked out. You can be checked out, you can be totally checked in, but you're mindlessly eating to the point where you are uncomfortably full, consuming more food than your body needs, or even more food than you really want at the end of the day. And then sometimes it's also followed up with a restrictive cycle. So it's sometimes just binge eating with normal eating or binge eating with a restricting cycle afterwards, which makes it really challenging and kind of keeps the snowball going. Anorexia is when we are restricting nutrients, restricting food intake. whether it be restricting scary foods, fear foods, or just restricting calories. You kind of see it all across the board. And usually it's related to body image. Sometimes I will see it related to anxiety. So let's say there's teenagers who get really, really stressed out about school, like they're a high performer and they want all A's and they just like can't even think about eating because they are maybe getting a B plus instead of an A. And so now they're just like debilitated and they can't eat. So they start losing a bunch of weight. There's usually weight criteria when it comes to diagnosing anorexia, or weight loss criteria too. Mm-hmm. So that's anorexia. And then bulimia is when you are purging or trying to get rid of extra calories in some way. So whether that be purging, vomiting, or excessive exercise, or using laxatives, diet pills, like that kind of thing. Any one of those can actually be a way to purge your body of extra energy.
When it comes to, I know sometimes with the binging too, it's kind of hand in hand with like the restrict and then mm-hmm. purge, restrict and purge. So it's kind of like,
it can be, yeah. Not always, but it definitely can be. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when it comes to helping diagnose, cause I'm sure do most of the clients that come work with you know already what they have, or do you have to sometimes put a name to it?
So I legally can't diagnose anything, but because this is what I do, I can see a client, you know, who's coming to me. And if they don't already have a specific diagnosis, usually they come with a referral from a doctor for like nutrition counseling or nutrition surveillance or something like, hey, something's up, don't know what, but you know, here, go see a professional. Which I appreciate, quick sidebar, I appreciate so much when doctors actually have a lot of respect for other care team providers, because sometimes doctors will just be like, oh yeah, you might be anorexic, like just eat a cheeseburger. And it's like, oh, well, oh my goodness, if only it was that easy, like we would have no issues, right? Yes. So doctors who work hand in hand with a care team and say like, hey, like talk to me, how did that session go? What are you noticing? They can put a diagnosis for the patient. Whether it be a diagnosis that they see is appropriate, or talking with the dietitian or even the therapist, psychiatrist. So they will give the diagnosis and, I will just kind of go from there. And sometimes it's explaining it to the client and saying like, hey, this is a very specific thing. Like this is usually why it happens, how we handle it, but
totally. Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I think that that is one of those, areas that is the trickiest to navigate in our day and age is, and I deal with it constantly with my, even when I was mostly training people, is that people be like, oh, I hurt this thing, or I did this thing, or I'm struggling with this thing, I'm going to go to my PCP. And a lot of it's just outside of the scope of a PCP, even yes. though their scope is so wide.
I know,
in a way.
I know.
But it is really tough because there's just there is still very much a level of kind of like ego, I think, that kind of exists there. They refuse to not be like, I don't know, or I don't have an answer, but this person might, you know. But I do think things are changing a bit.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's so true. I try really hard to be respectful of the doctor-patient relationship because I know a lot of people kind of think of them as like the end-all be-all, but I do have to be very honest with my clients and say, hey, listen, I'm not going to lie. Like I've had doctors as clients and they're like, yeah, we have no idea any of this. And so, I try to educate them and say like, make sure you're reaching out to appropriately educated people and ask the right questions to the right people. So it can be challenging. And some people definitely put up a fight and they're like, oh no, well my doctor X, Y, Z. And so I kind of just have to be like, okay, like it's their care. I'll give them the information and they can do with it what they want.
Exactly. It's like, I'll be here when you realize that it's not working or something. Yeah. Which is okay. No, I totally understand. And I agree with you because that is such a tight line to walk because you don't want to also lose trust, their trust in you with working with you as well. Because it's like, I'm not just trying to like shit on your doctor. That's not the point. The point is just that there might be other perspectives. And like, I've dedicated my whole life to this topic, you know, and I've told my listeners before that like I spent a long time trying to really understand the schooling that a lot of GPs and PCPs and all of them get when it comes to general care. And it's hardly any across the board. And it's a little scary because one of my best friends, he went through some of the top schools here in California for medical school. And we would text all the time and he'd share some of his curriculum with me. And he'd be like, why do you want to see that? And I'm like, I'm just curious. I'm not going to pay for UC Irvine, but and he was like, yeah, we spent like 30 minutes one day on like the Mediterranean diet. And that's it. And that's why your doctors will always say like the Mediterranean diet, which there's great things, but that's not realistic to real people's lives. You know,
it's not personalized. Yeah. And that's what you really need is like personalized care. Yes. Same thing with eating disorders. I'm not like, oh, you're anorexic. Cool. This is how we're going to handle it. Like full intakes. Talk to me about your background. How did we get, let's figure out how we got here. Mm-hmm. And then we can make a plan moving forward. Versus just like, oh, here's a pill, you're all better, you know?
Yes, yeah. Here's a pill or here's a pamphlet of what good and bad food lists. So let's actually talk a little bit more into that now.
Oh,
yeah. Segue. What are some things that you deal with as, you know, an eating disorder dietitian that you really want people to know to start to move away from?
Or So the very first thing I would say I touch on, and I try to approach it graciously. I've learned throughout my career that, especially in the beginning, that people get very defensive of this. It's just the verbiage. The verbiage that we use when we talk about food, it's wild. And you don't really notice it until you're made aware of it, right? So we grow up, I'm sure you grew up with either parents or relatives or friends saying like, oh, I don't eat that, that's bad for me. Or, oh, I ate so good today. Or, oh, I'm saving up all my calories so that I can just like totally have a great dinner and then dessert and eat a whole pint of ice cream. Like all these things, no one would ever bat an eye at that. For the most part, like that's just something that we commonly hear, good food, bad food, healthy food, especially parents who are trying to do their best for their kids. And this is why I have to have that conversation very gently, because I don't ever want to make a parent feel guilty for how they have tried to raise their kid, because they're just doing the best they can with the information that they have. Like, my field is a very niche thing. Disordered eating is a very niche thing. And so unless you have had experience with it yourself or have seen somebody gone through it, you're not aware of how these little comments actually kind of add up, right? So verbiage is the very first thing that I talk about. And I say like, hey, here is how we usually describe things. I make sure I normalize it. Like, yep, this is what we were all used to. Here's an alternative. Let's try to talk about food more neutrally. Let's try to avoid any kind of association with food equaling morality, good or bad. Let's take away the hierarchy that food has, like in our society. And so that's literally an entire conversation. And I would say you can kind of see it, especially on mom's eyes. Again, if I'm working with like a teenager, you can see it on mom's eyes where she's like, oh God, I say all those things, you know?
Yeah.
And then they start to kind of blame themselves. Like, is this my fault? Did I cause this? And again, I have to be very careful and very gentle and say, no, you have been, the fact that you're here with your kid, like you're doing the best you possibly can to try to take care of them. Like this isn't information that all of us knew growing up, you know? Dads are a little tougher, if I'm going to be honest.
Yes.
They're a little bit more. Sometimes I have very gentle, nurturing dads who are like, okay, like, tell me what else. What can I do? You know? But sometimes I have those dads who are like, this isn't even a real thing. Like, I don't understand why X, Y, Z. And I've been talking like this my whole life. Who cares? Yes. So I have to have very different conversations with those parents. Mm-hmm. And I actually love having both of them. But yes, verbiage is the one thing that I think, whether I'm working with a teenager and their parents or adults, it's the one thing that I talk about first, and then I continue and I tell them, I'm very open with them. I'm like, if you're comfortable with it, like this is what I'm going to kind of bring up every time we're talking and you're describing your day, your week, your meal, I'm going to be checking in and making sure that we're using neutral verbiage, and then I explain to them why and why it's important.
Yeah, no, totally. And I even remember early in my career with fitness, I would make some people, because they would want some ideas of foods that land in certain macro groups, whatever.
Right.
And I remember being like specific about saying like ideal and non-ideal
when
it came to certain foods, and being like, I need to describe to you why I have this specifically listed this way, because I do not want you to look at this as good foods, bad foods.
Yes.
So I think my first ever food chart I made said like, good and bad.
Oh,
and then I was just like, oh God, like, no.
And what's sad is, I want to kind of harp on my degree / our degrees for a second. Yeah. Like, that's what we're taught. Mm-hmm. Like, in our nutrition programs, there is no neutrality. It's get people to eat this way. This mm-hmm. is healthiest. This is ideal for their bodies. And so even I feel like I had to undo a lot of what I learned in my entire degree program and both my degree programs, because that's all we hear. Right. And until you realize, you know, you hear the 45-year-old who comes and says, oh, my mom used to say X, Y, Z when I was little, and it's just stuck with me forever. And I'm like, yes. Oh man, you never know what's going to stick and kind of be like the catalyst to these things happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say that is, when people ask me, I'll always tell them the toughest generation for me to break through to, or kind of help move out of certain narratives, is definitely anyone above the age of 40 right now. Because a lot of their parents were raised in the really like initially toxic, uh-huh. polarized,
yes.
no salt, no fat, no sugar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they still live with it. Like, I've got an 80-year-old client and he keeps going to the hospital for low sodium. And I'm like, homie,
you need
to eat salt.
Like, yeah, we need that. It's important.
Yeah. And he's like, well, salt's bad. My grandma told me. I'm like, your grandma was born in the
1800s. Yeah. Like, we have new information, sir.
Yeah, I know. It's so crazy. But I think that's really good that you attack that first, because I have found that, you know, especially with my younger clients, you know, breaking free from some of that, that is the hardest thing. Because, I mean, you build these little rules and you don't realize, or as a parent, you know, you don't realize that you're teaching your child rules. Mm-hmm. And some of them is just like, a lot of our brains want black and white. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff that's gray, you know, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. with nutrition.
Yes. Know. And it depends too on how I get this question a lot from parents. Maybe they have 4 kids and only one of their daughters develops an eating disorder. And they're like, why? They were all raised the exact same way. We said the exact same thing to all of them. Like, how could one of them have developed this eating disorder, but the other 3 didn't? And I'm like, there is also some brain chemistry going on. Like, it is not just environmental. Does environmental play a huge part? Yes, absolutely. But there's a lot to do with like your amygdala that leads to potential eating disorders as well. So sometimes it's just like the luck of the draw. I'm like, I'm so sorry, but you know, one out of every 10 people develop an eating disorder at some point in their life. So it just can sometimes happen.
Yeah. And I think too, one of those areas that is starting to get a little bit more attention as well is that, like, early life traumas. And, you know, we don't all get to control what traumas, large or small. I mean, there's a spectrum of what can be traumatizing to the brain. And I think that a lot of people underestimate how that also plays a huge role with food or need for control, mm-hmm. or, you know, a variety of those things. Mm-hmm. But kind of talking more about eating disorders, did you yourself, you know, if you're willing to share, have any relationship to disordered eating or any of that in your
life? I wouldn't say, and this is a great continued conversation about the difference between eating disorder and disordered eating. I wouldn't mm-hmm. say that I ever had a diagnosable eating disorder. I definitely had several instances in my life where I had some very, very intense disordered thoughts, is what I refer to them as. I had intense disordered thoughts that led to several weeks at a time of disordered eating. So I would never sit here and say like, oh my gosh, I've lived through that experience of having to go to higher level of care and residential or PHP or anything like that. But yes, I think, and if I'm being honest, I think most people have some level of disordered eating either currently in their life that they are trying to battle, or previously in their life they've tried to battle or had to battle.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I think a lot of the conversations through society are, well, you're struggling with this thing, it's because you should stop eating this thing
or
whatnot. Yeah. And like, that in its own is a disordered eating, like, phrase or concept. And so I think, you know, for me throughout high school, when you start to go through puberty and whatnot, and you're getting a little curvier as a female, and people mm-hmm. are like, oh, look at you getting, you know, whatever term they want to use. And you're mm-hmm. just like, should I not be or whatnot? And then mm-hmm. how do I stop this or that? And then it's like, okay, restricting food or throwing it up. Because I remember seeing like Lizzie McGuire. Do you remember, did you watch Lizzie McGuire?
A little bit, not a ton, okay. But I remember that there was
yes, there was a, episode about Miranda. Yes. And she was like, stopped eating and then she like fainted and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it was good because it brought awareness to that not being healthy, but at the same time, it put that on my radar. Like, I didn't even realize you could do something like that. Cause I was just like, why wouldn't I want to eat? Like, mm-hmm. I was raised in my Asian household and you finish your plate, which that on its own also is something that I'm sure you hear that a lot. I want to come back around to that because let's talk about binge eating soon.
Okay.
But yeah, I think that it's really hard because society does teach us also like through Disney Channel and stuff like those patterns.
Yeah, and that's challenging because there is a level of, I'll call it like competitiveness. Mm-hmm. When I don't know if I would say competitiveness, maybe sometimes, but there's a level of something when it comes to teenagers who have eating disorders, because they get this attention from either their family. Like, sometimes it's a way to control things, but sometimes it's also to get the attention that you want, whether it be from friends or family members or your significant other. And so sometimes that's a really hard battle to work past, is like doing something for the attention of it, because you start to do it for the attention and then it becomes so addicting that you're like, how do I get out of this at this point? You know? So, it's hard when you see that on TV shows, cause you're like, okay, it's bringing awareness. I love that. But it can sometimes have the opposite effect as well. Yeah. And it can kind of create some behaviors for people.
Totally. Yeah. And I do remember being like, oh, I overate and I feel bad about myself. Okay, well, I could just throw this up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
mm-hmm.
like, okay, but you shouldn't. You probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think that, like you were saying, it is one of those things that it's tricky because for girls, like especially young females, of the praise that is constantly given to a certain body type.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what it's like to be a middle schooler and high schooler right now with social media.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just, I'm so glad that we didn't have it exactly like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was starting
in MySpace.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like some things on Facebook, but there was no AI photo editing.
I know.
But all that to say, I think that this is a discussion that is really important to get into like the ears of our young females as well, to kind of catch themselves, like check yourself before you wreck yourself, because it is really tough to navigate dieting for the rest of your life. But let's talk a little bit more about binge eating, because I know quite a few people in my life and have had to kind of explore it more to try to better understand it to help them, mm-hmm. including past clients.
Mm-hmm.
But what would you say is kind of the most common patterns and conversations that you have with binge eating?
Yeah. So I usually start off, once I get all the information or a good chunk of the information, with the intake, I usually start off and explain it to them like, hey, there is a physiological component to this eating disorder, but there's also a psychological component to this eating disorder. And I usually say, I will dabble in the psychological components because that's just part of what we're doing. But that's a major thing that you need to discuss with your therapist. So, let's say there's a ton of anxiety or a need for control because their life feels out of control, or trauma. Like, those are all psychological components that could be contributing to them wanting to do something or feel some kind of way. And so, like I said, we'll dabble in that. But if it goes deep, if it's like real deep and real big, like, I need you to talk about that with your therapist. So that's the psychological component. Where my time to shine is with the physiological component. So oftentimes when I have a binge eating client come in, they are not fueling their body. Like, they're malnourished, which some people are like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm eating thousands of calories every single night. Like, how could I possibly be malnourished? Just because you are consuming more calories than your body needs, and you know this, like, just because you're consuming more calories than your body needs does not mean you are getting the nutrients that your body needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you could be having 3,500 calories worth of Oreos and ice cream every single night and still be malnourished. So your body is still, to some degree, going to tell you like, hey, I'm in need. Like, I need something. And so usually, not always, but usually there's a period of restriction after a binge. And so let's say you're binging at night. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. I'm not going to eat breakfast or lunch or dinner tomorrow. I'm going to try to like make up for all those calories that I ate. And then you restrict, 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 which leaves you starving and deprived of so many nutrients. So then by the time nighttime hits, your quote unquote willpower is gone and your body's screaming at you saying, oh my gosh, I need something. And so then you go and you binge again. So the very first thing I work on with clients is making sure that they are eating adequately. Even if they've had a binge the night before, okay, well, we are waking up and we are having a balanced breakfast, we are having a balanced lunch, we are having a balanced dinner. And slowly but surely, typically not right away, but slowly but surely within, I'm not gonna give like specific hard and fast timelines, but I would say within the first like week or so, they start to see binging totally diminish. And so they notice like, okay, I don't feel as strong a pull to the food at night because I'm eating earlier in the day. And as soon as they start to see that cycle break, it's usually like pretty exciting and motivating for them to be like, okay, like I am going to eat my 5-component breakfast. I am going to have what I need for lunch and dinner, because then they don't feel that pull as much at night. Now, that's a basic like idea of what we're talking about. But of course, there's always little things here and there that maybe come in as extra challenging or fears or whatever that may be. But I would say that's kind of like the blueprint of what totally. Usually happens.
Yeah, no, that's what I've seen too. And I would say it's another angle to it that a lot of people may, you know, like you said, not know that they're undernourished, even though they're overfed. That's like a common phrase, is that you're undernourished, but you're overfed.
Yeah.
And there's a huge difference there. And most of the time, I find, at least from my experience, a lot of binge eaters go for comfort foods, because especially if it's trauma related or something like that, or just anxiety related, like, because we do know like carbohydrates and yummy carbs and fats, like all those palatable things are like reward giving into our brain, you know, dopamine and all that. And so it's really important for people to know that, like, if you are doing that for those reward systems too, like there's definitely tangible things that are not food related.
Right.
And I do love the fact that you approach it from how do we balance out your day, because also balancing blood sugar, I mean, that's kind of a weird blanket term, because especially with like glucose goddess, it's kind of gotten confused, because now people are like, oh my God, I shouldn't have a sugar spike. And it's like,
it's a little more nuanced.
Yeah, exactly. But it, you know, there's a lot of things to strategize with it. But when it comes to, like you said, a 5-component breakfast, so tell me a little bit about that.
In the very first session after the intake, I typically call that like my nutrition education session. And I just dump a bunch of information, you know, up to what they can handle. But I just call it like it's an info dump. So we go over the 5 components of a meal, which is going to be carbs, proteins, fats, dairy, and then fruit and veggies in the same category. So when you're looking at a plate, we are aiming to have all 5 of those on a plate. And I do also go over why it's important to pair some of these foods together so that it can help give their body a hand in like blood glucose regulation and things like that. But if they are focused on getting 5 components in a meal, one, they're getting a ton of variety. They're getting the nutrients that they need. We also talk about like the volume of those foods. We need to make sure it's not just like a yogurt with a couple pinches of this and that. It needs to be like an adequate meal, right? But then we usually go into detail about each of the components and talk about how each of them benefit the body, which is wonderful, especially for every client. But I feel like the anorexic clients, or even the parents of an anorexic client, really bring the see a lot of value in that one, because then we're looking at food as this thing that nourishes our body, this thing that takes care of us. Like, oh, okay, I do need XYZ because it runs this part and that part of my body, you know? So I ask a lot of my clients in the sense that I'm like, hey, let's challenge ourselves this week, but I always want them to understand why I'm asking it. And so having that background and giving them that information means that I have a foundation that I can reference throughout all of our work together and say like, hey, this is why I'm suggesting what I'm suggesting, because we're trying to work on giving your body XYZ.
Totally. Yeah. Do you find that most people respond well to thinking about their nourishment as a way to take care of their body? Or do you find some people kind of really don't care about their overall health.
That's a great question. There are a fair few who don't care. I would say I see that more so in my very, very sick teenagers. And not just teenagers, adults too, but my very, very sick clients who are maybe resistant towards treatment. I see that mindset. However, I think that's not a good long-term motivator for some as well. Like when they, you can hear why these things are good for you or why they can help your body. But if you're scared of it, you're scared of it. And so it's good in the short term, which is why sometimes in treatment we try to, I don't want to say we try to go quickly, but we try to make sure that we are like being really efficient in sessions and getting that treatment going, because the longer that they are in treatment, the more likely they're going to hit treatment fatigue and then be like, I don't even care what protein does for me anymore. I don't care that I need fat. I don't care that XYZ happens in my body. They're just over it. Mm-hmm. So I would say in the short term, it's a really great motivator. But if they've been there, if it's kind of like really, really taking a long time, then they start to care less and less.
Yeah.
I've noticed. Yeah. But again, generalized statement. I'm not saying that's true for everybody, but you
know. No, I've definitely seen that too. Yeah. Even in the fitness side in the past too.
Oh, I'm sure. Like, I'm sure.
All about it. And yeah. Just like, yeah, I hate being so early. Yeah. I'm going to take Ozempic.
I wanted to make a quick note too, kind of rewind to when we were talking about binging, and we talked about how sometimes the choices at night are comfort foods. And great point there. And I think that there's also another side as well. Sometimes the choices at night are also foods that you deem bad. Yeah. Oftentimes, I would say they're foods that you deem as bad. And so all day you told yourself, I'm going to be good. I'm going to be good. I'm going to be good. I'm not going to have this. And then at night you're like, oh, I have no more, again, quote unquote, willpower.
Yeah.
I'm going to have the cinnamon rolls. I'm going to have the Cheez-Its. I'm going to have the goldfish. I'm going to have the pizza. Because we created this hierarchy. So alongside teaching them that there's the physiological and psychological components to these, again, I also bring in that conversation about verbiage and how we're thinking about food and really pull that into the binge clients, especially if they're leaning towards those foods at night, so that they can take away that value. And then that, so I'll add it into the day. Like, okay, with lunch, with your adequate lunch today, I want you to add 4 Oreos, or what do you think an appropriate size of ice cream is? Okay, cool. Let's have that with lunch every day for a week. And that's a whole conversation in and of itself, food exposures, but, that's really helpful too. And effective.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I remember one of my clients used to struggle with, anorexia through a lot of her youth. And, you know, to your point of the attention thing, it was, her dad was very busy, always working, that kind of thing. She would typically use it to get to the point of needing to go to the hospital so that he'd have to show up, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was very interesting. Yeah. But fortunately, when I had met her, she had worked with some clinical dietitians and stuff in her youth. But we had to come back around to that because now she had started using fitness as a means to control all of that. And that's another interesting angle to it as well. But that would be kind of combined into orthorexia, correct? Yeah. Can you give our listeners a little definition of orthorexia?
It's when you have become obsessed with making the exact right decision all the time. So if I have a choice between a cheeseburger and a hot dog because I'm at a barbecue, well, which one is going to be the most nutrient dense? And is this cheeseburger, is the burger organic and non-GMO and, you know, pasture raised, you know, all those things. It's when you become so obsessed with like the minute details that you eliminate a lot of food options in your diet. And that starts to be very restrictive in and of itself. And there's a lot of anxiety and stress usually associated with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which that's a really good, other eating disorder that I see, especially on social media a lot with these like health gurus is that like, now you're only eating clean and clean. A lot of research behind that is also not too far to the other side.
Yes.
Have you worked with orthorexia?
Yes. And it's hard because just like you said, that is depending on who you follow on social media, like that is so prevalent. People telling you this is good, this is bad, don't eat this because inflammatory XYZ. And there can be some truth to the things that are said. Like, oh, don't eat sugar, it's inflammatory for your body. Okay, that's true. Like, a ton of sugar is inflammatory for your body. But what I tell people is anything not in moderation is not good for your body. There are even some healthy foods that, if eaten in excess, are not good for your body. So there's a phrase that I learned off of, it was a TikToker, but I use it all the time now, and it's the poison is in the dose. It only becomes harmful, or it gets more and more harmful the more that we have. So if you are already applying moderation to your life and you are bringing these things in an intentional way, like, your body can handle it. Trust your body. It knows what to do with a cinnamon roll. I bring those up a lot because they're my favorite. But it knows what to do with a cinnamon roll or ice cream or a cheeseburger or pizza. Like, it knows. It can handle it. Now, if we're having cheeseburgers and ice cream for breakfast, lunch, and dinner every single day, that's not intentional. That's not intuitive. Mm-hmm. So I usually tell them that. Like, we can trust that our body knows what to do with these things.
Totally. Yeah. And I think learning the cues and the feedback that food gives you is also, like, helpful for, like, learning your unique limitations, you know, and your dose, so to speak, you know.
Yes, because that's different for everybody. Again, there's no one size fits all. What might feel good for me might not feel good for you, you know. So that's intuitive eating right there, is paying attention to your body. And that's something that's very interesting, because people don't have that a lot of times. People, I think about college students who are just surviving off of, like, pizza and water, soda, whatever, and they're just trying to get through their life. They are not paying attention to how they feel after a meal every night. They're not like, oh, this was so energizing. No, they're just trying to get through their life. So then you are a busy teenager, and then you go to college, and then you, like, have this stress of a new life and career when you're done. That doesn't leave a lot of space for learning about your body. Not to mention, a lot of people just don't necessarily know how to teach their kids how to be in touch with their body. So that is something that I will tell clients, because they get frustrated. They're like, I should know how to eat. I should know how to listen to my body. Like, this is so stupid. I hear that all the time. This is so stupid. I can't believe I'm struggling with this. This is so dumb. And I'm like, okay, but think about it. Like, you weren't taught how to do that. So we are going all the way back to childhood. We are literally starting from scratch, and we are learning how to eat and then listen to our body after we eat, or before, during, whatever it may be. And so that's another big conversation that I have, regardless of the eating disorder that we're working with. That's a big conversation too. Like, how do I learn how to be intuitive and actually pay attention to what my body's telling me? Because it will help you guide your decisions.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that's the funny phrase of, I don't know what makes us think that, like, I should have this already. Uh-huh. And, you know, like, with favorite phrases, I like that you shouldn't should on yourself.
Yes.
Because it's just like, okay, but you do. Yep. So it's okay. Like, whatever, you know.
Yes.
But I realize, like, getting to that point of stopping caring about a lot of those things or putting a lot of weight on those is really hard to navigate, especially when you're young, because you don't realize, like, you know. You get your aha moments when you hit 25. but to kind of, like, finish up and go back onto the binge eating, what are some things that you found help your clients, patients, move forward from binge eating, from not only just more well-rounded meals and stuff throughout the day? What are, do you ever reorient attention for getting, you know, like, those dopamine reward systems from other things, if it's related to that, or you know, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. And I think that's different for everybody, depending on what it is that's leading them to binge. For people who are more, like, dopamine seeking or serotonin seeking, nourishing themselves earlier in the day really does help. It doesn't take care of everything, but it's a huge step. Like, that physiological component at least isn't, like, screaming at them anymore. And then it's like, okay, and now what are we going to do with our night? If your go-to was at 8 p.m., I'm going to go sit on my bedroom floor and play video games surrounded by a bunch of snacks. Okay, then maybe we pause that. Maybe you play video games in the living room, and maybe you make yourself this, like, delicious charcuterie board that you can snack on in a balanced and intentional way. there's this quick kind of a side note. There's this video that I use on YouTube a lot. It's a raisin meditation video. And it's 12 minutes long, and it's this British woman who is walking you through how to eat a raisin for like 12 minutes. What? And I know it sounds so silly when I run it in groups. They're like, what are you making us do? But they love it at the end of it. And the reason why I like it, and I will frequently do it with clients in session, is because it is forcing them to pay attention to every single sense that is experiencing this raisin. Mm-hmm. So they, you, at one point in the video, you like squish it by your ear to see if it makes a sound. You smell it, you put it on your lips, but then you pay attention to how your body's reacting as you put it on your lips, and then you hold it on your tongue. Like, it's a whole process. But as soon as they recognize that their bodies actually react to a single raisin in that way, it gives them an idea of what they should be looking for when they are eating. So practicing intentional eating is a big one. It takes away the distraction of like, well, what if I eat too much? What if I do this? What if I do that? Because they're focused on something. They're focused totally on what their body is telling them. Yeah. And then doing something that brings them joy. So maybe we paint. Maybe we talk to a friend. A lot of people do that. Maybe we go out and do this interaction with, you know, a mom, a sister, a friend, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's distraction mixed with intention. Like, we don't want to just distract and pretend like we're not listening to our body. That's not going to work. But changing your environment, doing something joyful while being intentional, those are some big game changers.
Totally. Yeah, no, that's really great advice, because I think we underestimate just how much like community and all of that gives us that same, mm-hmm. like you said, not distraction, like an intentional distraction. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I think nowadays we just, I mean, the food messaging is all around us. We're constantly seeing it even on GPS apps being like, maybe I want a burger.
Yeah.
No, I'm just trying to get my dentist appointment, actually. But
it's so true. So,
yeah, it's really weird. And I that's another thing that I tell a lot of my clients is that, like, hey, like, a lot of this isn't your fault. Like, a lot of this is, like, kind of capitalistic marketing that's just pushed on us. And it's, you're going to have to be a warrior that's very specific about avoiding these things.
Yeah.
You know? But like you said, with some of those different ways that we approach finding other things that bring us joy, I think that that's a really great thing to focus on. And sometimes I've, like, in the past, told, like, why don't you go on a walk if you feel like you need to snack or something.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
You know, mm-hmm. assuming you have somewhere that's good to walk.
Yes.
Especially because it is usually at night, you know, when these things hit. And it's like, okay, well, a lot of people don't really want to walk outside. Maybe they don't live somewhere that's, like, safe to walk outside at night. Super valid, you know. But at the same time, finding other ways to do it, like you said, like, you don't have to just hide in your room and mm-hmm. eat your snackies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think another point to make is everything that we're talking about right now, all these, like, ideas of how to handle this might sound like a lot of work, and it is. Like, I'm usually very honest with my clients about that too. They're like, oh my God, this sounds like such a pain. And I'm like, yeah, it's effort. Like, mm-hmm. helping yourself in this way is effort. If it was easy, everybody would do it and would be feeling great. But, like, you're here talking with me because you're ready for this. So it's a lot of work to start, but I promise you it does get easier to the point where now this is your normal. This is your second nature, where you're like, oh, let's check in. How's my body feeling? Like, do I need more? Do I want to pause and have this later? And some of my favorite moments are when they start to realize that, and maybe like a month, 2-3 months in, they're like, oh my gosh, remember when I used to have to work really hard to do that? And now I don't even have to think about it. I'm like, yeah, I told you, like, it gets so much easier. So yes, everything that we're suggesting is a bit of effort that you have to put in, but it really will become second nature at some point.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's a really good note to make kind of as we're closing our discussion out, because I recently saw something from this guy. I think his name's like Corey Mascar or something like that. And he makes really interesting therapy videos. And he was talking about, you know, for cycle breakers in family and generational trauma and all that. Like, the reason that you are considering breaking the cycle is because you are capable of it. And I think the same thing to be said about, you know, eating disorders is the fact that you're trying or is already showing that you're capable of doing it. You know, but it definitely is one of those things where you have to, like, really dig deep into your resilience, you know, and trying to build some self-confidence in those things. And I think all the little step-by-step habits that you're teaching a lot of your patients and such is what builds that confidence. You know, you do have to just make those little wins, because all the little wins stack up. And a lot of people just think that, oh, but I didn't lose 20 pounds, or, you know, big markers that we're taught mean something. And those don't mean as much as, learning to, you know, become intuitive with your body and trust yourself and take better care of yourself, you know. We kind of have to keep rewriting those narratives and help people see that, the importance in it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So as we close up today's discussion, I know there's so much to talk about still, and so maybe we'll just have to have you back on the podcast. But are there any other projects or things that you are doing in with your business or moving forward or thinking about doing that you'd love to share?
So no new projects right now. I'm really working on focusing on continuing my education and just learning more about certain populations. So that's my focus right now.
No, that's awesome. Are there any ones that you're dabbling in right now that you're really excited about?
Yeah, so I tend to lean a bit more towards the holistic side of the world. I think that Western medicine absolutely has a place, but I think that the holistic side does as well. So I feel like I'm kind of somewhere right in the middle. And so learning, oftentimes there are coexisting conditions when it comes to eating disorders. Maybe it's an older woman who's gone through menopause or a 35-year-old who has PCOS or, you know, things like that. And so just learning more about women's hormones and how they come into play with their body and why it might be causing certain things to happen. I think that can be really important to help educate clients on. So I myself am continuing to try to learn more about that all the time.
Same. Yeah, we're on the same page there. I found that for the longest time, especially being immersed in like bro science world in my early career, but like always kind of rejecting it or being skeptical.
Yeah.
It's interesting how much people kept saying like, it's not your hormones, it's not your thyroid, la, 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 la.
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like when you actually learn about that stuff, it's absolutely those things.
Yes.
Those things play huge roles. They're like, they're why we even have a metabolism.
Right, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I would have thought.
I know. And in understanding environmental toxins, you know, it's a lot of like what brought me back to school is like there's functional testing that has a huge place alongside conventional medicine. And I think a lot of conventional medicine underplays some of those things because it's like, well, why wouldn't you want to preventatively test, you know?
Yeah.
And so all that kind of stuff is great.
That can be a hard conversation to have with clients sometimes because they might already be in such a restrictive mindset. And so to then talk about other things like that, I have to tread very lightly on that. And I usually don't do it until they are more secure in their recovery. But sometimes that does come up. And so just depending on what they're going through. So
especially
navigating those are always interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, you see a whole very much more specific side than I see because I am mostly working with gen population. And so it's like when you get into that specialty side, you've got like very particular personalities and, you know, and I mean, eating disorders do rewire your brain to some extent. I mean, maybe to a lot of extent, would you say? And so I think that that's another angle that is interesting that you have to, those waters you have to swim. or tread, whatever the phrase is. But okay, so I like to close up my episodes asking a good question, as you know, as you've been prepared for.
Yeah.
So in what way, if any, do you find yourself a wellness rebel?
So in this world, this eating disorder world, when it comes to the providers that work in it, I feel like there are extremes. I'm not a fan of extremes personally. I don't think it works well for clients. I also don't think it works well for personalized care. So oftentimes in this world, when you are working with eating disorders, you're also working with body image a lot of the times. That's a very important part of all of this, which I also agree with. But I think when you are working with people, sometimes they can come in larger bodies, and a lot of practitioners will tell them, oh, well, if your body wants to be this size, like this is the size it's going to be forever, like you should just stay here and like not worry about it. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I'm never going to enter a professional relationship and think something about someone's body. If they are living a larger body and they are thriving and comfortable and feel like they can live their life to the fullest, I'm like, awesome. This is you. Like, this is like, let's learn how to love this body, like that kind of thing, right? But if they're uncomfortable, if things have happened if they've like gained a lot of weight over the last month and they don't know what's going on, like I tend to obviously have that conversation about like loving, accepting our body where it's at, but I'm also teaching them how to take care of themselves mm-hmm. and be intuitive about what their body needs. And so, I think sometimes that can be a little bit different than how someone on the more extreme scale of like, no, like it doesn't matter what they weigh, like this is where their body wants to live. And I'm like, that might not be true. It might be true. It absolutely might be true. And we can love and accept our body for where it's at, but it also could be something going on and maybe their body doesn't want to live where it's at right now. I don't necessarily ever go into a session saying like, okay, weight loss, this is what we're doing. That is never something that you will hear out of my mouth, but I am open to the idea that if we start to make changes and they do start to either gain or lose weight, depending on what they need, that it absolutely is okay if that's where their body needs to be. And I think that sometimes that can be a little controversial in this world.
A little rebellious. Yeah, no, I love that though. Yeah, I think that that's a really important perspective to have, because that is really unique to the fact that I do find also a lot of practitioners like to be black and white. And
yes.
Navigating the gray area is definitely something that takes a special approach,
yes.
but is really valuable because, yeah, you know, like everything you said, it is a really good way to view health and eating disorders specifically. Right. So that's great. Thank you so much, Mariah, for being here. How can people connect with you? And of course, for everyone listening, you can just head to the show notes for the direct links. And well, I'm going to actually also have you send me the grape meditation listening wants to play with the grape.
Yeah, I absolutely will. I sent you a couple links. One for... it's NIDA, so it's a website that gives you a ton of information about finding a provider and just kind of learning a bit more about eating disorders. And then there's another one called Feast, and that is for loved ones of someone who has an eating disorder. Like if you need immediate support, suggestions on how to combat certain things that are happening, both of those are great websites to kind of go for some support, some help. There's also another website that I sent you. I'm totally blanking on the name right now.
Project Heal.
Yes, Project Heal. Thank you. If you are somebody who can't afford support because maybe your insurance doesn't cover it, they do offer scholarships to work with dietitians who have donated their time. So all three of those are amazing resources if you feel like you are dealing with something or if you know someone who's dealing with something. And then if you want to find me, I'm at sakaranutrition.com. And there's a little bit more about me and my approach to things. And yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being with us. And I love all of those additional resources you've provided. That is amazing. So everybody, let's give a nice thank you to Mariah for being here. I'll catch you on another episode next week of Rebel Wellness. What did you think about that episode? If you enjoyed it, I hope that you would come join my community on Instagram at Rebel Wellness Podcast or my coaching page at Kaylee Loren or both. I would love to see your name pop up on my new follows list. I might say hello if I catch you. And I would also like to invite you to come check out my website, coachkales.com, if you're interested in seeing any more of the educational learning resources I have created for you. I have a whole ton of amazing free downloads that you can like dip your toe in the water of what working with me looks like. And if you are really vibing with what I have to say and how I teach it, come explore my courses that are available for purchase. They are all do-it-yourself. In the near future, I plan to have some awesome group coaching that will be all live, so stay tuned for that. And the best way to know when I'm going to launch those is through my monthly wellness newsletter, which is my hand-curated, not AI-generated, monthly all things health and wellness newsletter that I created to be your new favorite resource for staying up to date with the latest in the health world, self-care resources that I've created, and a bunch of the clean beauty picks that I personally use myself and a whole lot more, as well as early access and discounts to anything that I create in the future for specifically my newsletter sign up. So if you'd like to sign up, head to coachkales.com and add yourself to my mailing list. Last but not least, I would absolutely love it if you would help our podcast grow by simply sharing a rating or review wherever you stream and are listening to me right now, and share it on your social medias or text it to some friends or family members if this episode resonated and was something that you think could help somebody else, because I really would love to help anybody in your circle if I've been helping you. So I absolutely am so grateful that you're here. And if you listened all the way through, you are a real one. So all right, Rebel, until next episode.